This is the Informer Podcast.
This is Toby Halligan for the Informer Podcast. This is an extended interview I did with Dr. Siobhan Irving on the impact the Sultan of Brunei's homophobic laws and the resulting backlash is having on queer Muslims. Siobhan is an anthropologist specializing in gender and sexuality in Southeast Asia, and she is the treasurer and an executive committee member of the Queer Muslim Collective that's based in Sydney. Our conversation included a number of interesting tangents, including the role of Saudi Arabia in spreading homophobic hatred around the world. Thank you for listening. After the passing of these laws in Brunei, there's obviously been a reaction around the world and quite a substantial backlash. What's been the response within Australia's LGBTIQ plus Muslim community to these laws?
Well, we're very sorry that this came to pass, because all we can see is the several different ways that these laws and the reaction to these laws from people outside of our community will make our lives more difficult. Mm. We feel that now that these laws have been passed, they do nothing but confirm biases and negative stereotypes about Islam in the minds of non-Muslims. And we are already, several times in our lives, find ourselves in positions where we feel we need to defend having both a Muslim and an LGBTQ plus identity at the same time. And we think that the passing of these laws is only going to increase that. We're going to be put more and more on the spot and forced to sort of defend our position.
Mm. And do you mind me asking, when you say you have to defend your position, is that something that's part of daily life? Is that to other members of the LGBTIQ plus community?
Well, for some of us, it will be in our daily life, especially those of us who live openly as LGBTQ plus identifying Muslims. People are always very curious about how we can reconcile our spirituality and our sexuality when the sort of mainstream discourse is that Islam is very against same-sex intimacy and non-normative gender identities. So this kind of questioning can come from colleagues, it can come from friends, and yes, most certainly it can come from other people in the mainstream queer community who aren't Muslim. Mm. Oftentimes, actually, the most aggressive questioning comes from others within the queer community, because, and this comes from a place of kindness, it usually comes from a beautiful place of wanting to genuinely help someone. Others within the queer community often look at us and feel that our problems would be solved if we could just give up Islam. They see Islam as the problematic element in our lives many times, because it's true. Queer Muslims do suffer oftentimes within Muslim communities. We suffer from discrimination, we suffer from a lack of understanding, and the laws that have been passed in Brunei, unfortunately, are likely to add to that for some.
Mm.
The people within the queer community, they see this and they want to help often, but they don't quite understand the nuances. They don't understand the history of queer identities within Muslim communities. They don't understand the great diversity that exists within and between Muslim communities, and because of that, they just don't get oftentimes how you can be Muslim and queer at the same time.
Right, and what's something you would want the mainstream queer community to understand about the queer Muslim community?
I would like them to understand, and I don't think I speak for myself only on this, I would like them to understand that our spirituality and gender identity or sexuality are not mutually exclusive. I would like them to understand that there's no inherent contradiction in being a queer person and being a Muslim. I would like them to understand that there is space, and historically there has been space in Muslim communities for non-normative genders and sexual orientations, and that we're not an innovation. And also that we're not a problem. We're not problematic. We're not doing Islam wrong. We're not kind of like wrong or mistaken or damaged Muslims. We are perfectly fine the way we are. And we have always been.
I think that's quite a beautiful sentiment. Would you say that these laws that have been passed in Brunei are actually, I mean, using the phrase good Islam is obviously, you know, is fraught, but do they reflect a credible interpretation of Islam?
Well, whether they do or not depends very much on who you ask. And within Muslim communities, this is a very common point, because you see, Islam, unlike other religions such as Catholicism, we have no central religious authority. The Catholic Church is the Pope and the Vatican. We don't have anybody. We have a body of tradition. We have the canonical sources of Islam. We have the Quran and we have the Hadith literature, which is the sayings and deeds of Prophet Muhammad, which were recorded during his lifetime. And what is a correct or an incorrect interpretation of the Quran or this body of literature, or even the Islamic law that emerged from the two, is really a matter of interpretation. Now, as queer Muslims, we assert that nobody has the right really to tell us that we cannot make an interpretation of these primary religious sources. We have access to the same scholarship that everybody else does. But more than that, we tend to draw upon the principles that we find within Islam, and that's compassion and mercy, right? The individual chapters of the Quran start, with very, very few exceptions, with the words, "In the name of God, most merciful, most compassionate." And we believe that with this emphasis on mercy and compassion, laws like what have been introduced in Brunei and elsewhere that punish same-sex intimacy, that punish things that cannot really be helped, right? Nobody chooses their sexual orientation. We don't believe that that is congruent with a God who is compassionate and merciful. So we have arrived at the interpretation that there is no conflict. And as I mentioned before, this has historical precedent. There's no record of Prophet Muhammad killing anyone for being queer. There's no punishment in the Quran, and the Quran is the most important source of religious knowledge for any Muslim. And there's no punishment for homosexuality or a queer gender identity in the Quran. So we see this, and we reflect on this, and we've arrived at our own way of reconciling our spirituality and our either gender identities or sexual orientations. We're not proselytizing. I'm not going to stand here and say, all Muslims must agree with me. Queer Muslims are not doing that either. We're not a kind of a religious movement. We're not seeking to convert others to our point of view. We just want to assert our right, our Islamic right, to exist.
It sounds, a lot of what you're saying reminds me of conversations I've had with queer Christians. It is notable, I think, that within the Islamic world, so Saudi Arabia is the most obvious example, there are a number of quite horrific dictatorships that often have, you know, colonial roots. So in Saudi Arabia, for our audience who may be unaware of this, the House of Saud basically has an arrangement with the Wahhabi sect, who have quite extreme interpretations of Islam. They adopt a Sufiist perspective that's extremely traditional and has a lot of pretty horrific attitudes. And they've done that deal to remain in power. It seems to me like the Sultan of Brunei has brought these laws in partly out of the economic circumstances in his country. Do you think that's the case?
Yes, I think that could be a potential explanation. There has been a lot of economic uncertainty in the world thus far, and I could see how he may want to strengthen relationships with certain states like Saudi Arabia. And interestingly, the bar for getting convictions for, say, sodomy or I believe there are other crimes that are liable for capital punishment, such as rape and...
Adultery, I believe, is one. I think
yes, and where the maximum penalty is death, mm-hmm. the bar for achieving convictions on these is almost impossibly high. There must be four Muslim male witnesses to the act in order for it to be prosecuted.
Mm.
So this could also be a very convenient way for the Sultan to look very religious, to appear as very pious, but actually not carry out any of these. Punishment.
It is interesting because when you look at the Sultan's record, I think he's on to wife number six. He has three presently, he has divorced three. You look at the conduct of his brother who has a yacht called Tits and lifeboats called Nipple One and Two and has a large harem. I mean, they break their own laws. Obviously, they're not subject to them because they're sovereigns. But I guess I wonder, and I think the reason why this is an important point for our audience is a lot of people have understandably been quite alarmed at these laws. They're concerned that if a flight gets diverted through Brunei, there's a chance that they'll be subject to punishment by them. But if the motivation is a political one, that's not to say the laws shouldn't be condemned and that the Sultan's company shouldn't be boycotted. I think that's a great idea. But it goes to the question of whether or not people are actually going to experience the consequences from these laws. Do you think that there's been an overreaction within the Australian media and the international media to the implementation of these laws?
Well, yes, but unfortunately that doesn't surprise me at all. I think the country first introduced these Islamic laws in 2014, and while it was meant to be a gradual implementation, they all sort of got dumped on the country last Wednesday, I believe, or sometime shortly before then. And these, when the country first introduced this, the legal system became twofold, right? There was common law, and then there was Islamic law. And the Islamic law really, in large part, for the overwhelming majority of it, only applies to Muslims. So no, if a plane full of foreigners were diverted to Brunei, I'm sure nobody would have anything to worry about on the face of that. Mm. Also, as far as even people within Brunei, yes, of course, if anybody is... in a same-sex partnership or they are gender diverse, there's a lot to be concerned about right now. However, it perhaps does not warrant the alarmism that we have seen in the press. And I base that on the fact that homosexuality was already illegal in Brunei, and Brunei has had the death penalty all throughout this time, and yet I don't believe an execution has actually been carried out in Brunei since the 50s.
Yeah.
So this is not a country that has a record of barbaric punishments to the degree that we are, the press is dressing it up right now. Mm. I see a lot of sensationalism in the media. And yes, like you said, absolutely, we need to condemn this. It's a damaging discourse. It's not okay on any level. But we also need to not get carried away at the threat level.
Does this suggest something, though, do you think, and I know you've worked in the Southeast Asian region studying gender and sexuality, do you think, does this suggest a direction that LGBTIQ plus rights are going in Southeast Asia?
Unfortunately, I would believe so. We have increasingly conservative religious movements in Malaysia and Indonesia that are pointedly against gay rights, against LGBTQ plus rights. And unfortunately, I think that the Sultan of Brunei has seen this and seen an opportunity in it to make himself look very, very pious. But indeed, if this discourse weren't already existing, he perhaps wouldn't have had the motivation to bring these laws in now. But yes, I would absolutely agree with that. There's And I use the word conservative, and I think that I should probably clarify that because, as I've already stated, there's nothing inherently within Islam or within the most trusted sources of Islam, I should say, that is intrinsically against LGBTQ plus rights or ways of living or loving. So conservative isn't perhaps the right word to use. I believe that a lot of these religious movements are very influenced by Wahhabi thought. And you had mentioned the Wahhabi movement in Saudi Arabia. It's a reform movement that has a very, very specific idea of what a Muslim is, what Islam is, and what true piety, what true Muslim behavior should be. Mm. A very, very narrow interpretation, and it's actually a very, very new interpretation. It's only been around since, the 1800s, I believe. It's not been around for very long time.
This kind of raises for me an interesting question, and again, just some context for our listeners who might not be aware of this, but because of that arrangement between the House of Saud and the Wahhabis in Saudi Arabia, Saudi Arabia has spent tens of billions of dollars spreading Wahhabism throughout much of the world. They spread it to Pakistan, to Indonesia, to Malaysia. They build madrasas, religious schools and mosques. They fund talks. They've been enormously influential off the back of Saudi Arabia's oil wealth. And right now, Australia, despite the statements Maurice Payne and other ministers have laudably made on Brunei, Australia is selling billions of dollars of weapons to Saudi Arabia. Do you think our energies might be better spent on perhaps focusing the attention on, you know, this larger problem rather than Brunei, which, while it's worth condemning it, the real heart of the issue, if we want to talk about the spread of problematic interpretations of Islam, and by problematic I mean aggressively anti-queer, regressive interpretations, might be best spent focusing our energies on, say, whether Australia should have arms deals with Saudi Arabia.
Oh, absolutely. It's very, very hypocritical to publicly denounce the Sultan of Brunei while continuing to do business with the Saudis, because as you mentioned, they've been busy using their petrodollars to export the very, very worst kinds of homophobia. With their sort of brand of Islam, they're exporting not only homophobia, but lots of very, problematic from an Islamic point of view, viewpoints. Mm. Now, that's not necessarily just my opinion. There are lots of scholars, Islamic scholars, who know far, far more about these matters than I do, who have already pointed that out. Mm. So yes, absolutely. It's very, very problematic to continue doing business with the Saudis while condemning somebody else for basically espousing the same values.
And the other context to this is also a deeply problematic conversation that Australia has been having around asylum seekers in the near future. Do you think these laws create an extra moral imperative for Australia to take LGBTIQ plus asylum seekers from Brunei and other Southeast Asian countries?
I believe that moral imperative has really already existed for quite some time. As far as anybody who is at risk, whether it's in Brunei or elsewhere, I believe that we have a moral duty as a country of plenty to look after those who are in need. Mm. I believe that should go without much argument. That should go without saying. Mm. If we have any conscience at all, of course we would want to protect those who are at risk from domestic laws that persecute them for things that they cannot change, such as their sexual orientation or gender identity.
If people want to learn more about the work that Sydney Queer Muslims does, where should they go?
Well, we have a web presence. If you visit sydneyqueermuslims.org.au, you'll find a range of resources as well as information about us and the work that we do. And we have a comment box there, so feel free to get in touch with us, especially if there's anything that you believe that we might be able to do for you or help you with.
Wonderful. Siobhan Irving, thank you so much for joining us here on The Informer.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
This has been The Informer. If you enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe and review on iTunes. It helps others to find the show.